Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Cytomegalovirus frequently occurs in hematopoietic stem cell transplant recipients and can cause significant morbidity and mortality. Traditionally, ganciclovir and valganciclovir have been used for CMV prophylaxis and treatment, but their myelosuppressive properties can be problematic. Letermovir, a new antiviral agent, does not share these myelosuppressive effects. Today, Dr. Michaela Rice, a clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic, discusses a growing body of evidence that supports letermovir's use in CMV prophylaxis.
CMV seroprevalence ranges anywhere from 50 to over 90% in the general population. So it's a very common infection, but in most patients, it doesn't cause any significant problems. When patients are severely immunosuppressed, such as following transplant, we can see reactivation of latent CMV infections that cause significant morbidity and mortality. In my presentation today, I'm going to be focusing on one of our newer antiviral medications, letermovir, which is indicated specifically for prophylaxis against CMV in patients who have received allogeneic stem cell transplants. Following my presentation, you should be able to explain the difference between preemptive and prophylaxis strategies for CMV infection prevention, select patients that may benefit from letermovir prophylaxis based on existing literature, and then identify areas of investigational use of letermovir. Throughout my presentation, we'll be following along with our patient, MR. MR is a 47-year-old female with a history of acute myeloid leukemia who is day plus 10 from an allogeneic stem cell transplant. She received bone marrow from a haploidentical donor with a myeloablative conditioning regimen that included fludarabine, melphalan, and total body irradiation. She is CMV seropositive and has a seronegative donor and has no known drug allergies. Her post-transplant immunosuppression includes cyclophosphamide, tacrolimus, and mycophenolate. When we're considering what opportunistic infections our patient is most at risk for, we have to think of different time periods following transplant. In the immediate pre-engraftment time frame, which is the days 0 to 30 following a transplant, the patients have profound neutropenia. They'll also have mucositis, which may cause a breakdown of mucosal barriers for entry of infection. And they'll have central catheters placed for administration of medications and transfusions. They're also at highest risk during this time frame for acute GVHD. During this time, patients may have gram-positive or gram-negative bacterial infections, HSV, fungal infections, and other viral infections. After we achieve engraftment, the type of risk factors for infection shift. And now we're more concerned for impaired cellular immunity and impaired humoral immunity. We're also at risk at this time point for chronic GVHD. And this is when we tend to see patients develop CMV reactivation or CMV infection. So going back to our patient, a typical antimicrobial prophylaxis strategy may include penicillin or levofloxacin, posaconazole, acyclovir, and following engraftment when we're not as worried about myelosuppressive effects, Bactrim. And the main question that we'll be addressing is whether or not we should be providing CMV prophylaxis, and if so, how or with what. For some background on CMV, as I said, it's very common in the general population. The seroprevalence varies based on age, geographic location, and socioeconomic status. It's a double-stranded DNA virus of the herpes virus family and can cause moderate or subclinical infection in immunocompetent adults, but significant morbidity and mortality in our transplant populations. The clinical course of CMV is characterized by a primary infection, at which point we'll see a rapid increase in viral replication that's quickly kind of slowed down by our body's innate immunity. So these are our cytokines and co-stimulatory molecules. Within about a week, we'll see our body's adaptive immunity form. So we'll see CMV-specific CD4 T cells and CD8 T cells. At this time, CMV will also disseminate to reservoir cells within our body and will form a latent infection within myeloid progenitor cells, monocytes, and endothelial cells, And throughout a patient's lifetime, we might see brief periods of CMV reactivation that would be quickly tampered down by those CD4 and CD8 memory cells that we have. When a patient undergoes a transplant, we essentially wipe out that adaptive immunity that we've formed and that memory immunity. And so we'll see an increase in CMV reactivation and an increase in our viral replication that may extend for a significant period of time. And while we see recovery of our neutrophils fairly quickly after transplant, for patients who have undergone a stem cell transplant, it takes a much longer time for adequate recovery of our functional lymphocytes. When thinking about CMV in immunocompromised hosts, we have to differentiate between a CMV infection and CMV disease. An infection is defined as detection of CMV DNA in a blood sample. So this is typically done using a CMV PCR, and it'll detect any viral level within our blood. CMV disease, on the other hand, involves the presence of signs or symptoms compatible with CMV end organ involvement. For diagnosis to be confirmed, we must have detection of CMV in the involved specimen, which typically requires a biopsy. I want to point out that many patients will experience CMV reactivation or CMV infection, and this rate can range anywhere from 30% to 70%, depending on the patient's risk factors, but not as many patients will develop CMV disease. So looking at how CMV disease manifests in patients, we often see it manifest within the gastrointestinal tract, and this can sometimes be difficult to differentiate between a diagnosis of graft versus host disease. Pneumonitis related to CMV carries one of the highest mortality risks, and other manifestations such as retinitis, hepatitis, and encephalitis are less common. When considering risk factors for patients following an allogeneic stem cell transplant, CMV seropositive status at baseline is one of the main risk factors, and this stems from the fact that those patients have had a prior CMV infection. When they receive a myeloablative conditioning regimen, their immune capabilities that they have formed prior to transplant are no longer able to tamper down that CMV reactivation. Other risk factors include umbilical cord source blood, mismatched or unrelated donors, graft versus host disease, which might confer an infectious risk related to the disease itself or to the increased amount of immunosuppression, low CD4 T cell count, and undetectable CMV specific T cell immunity, which is something that can be monitored if necessary. So there was this study conducted using the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research Database that included patients with a variety of different hematological malignancies who received an allogeneic stem cell transplant between 2003 and 2010. And their primary objective was to analyze the impact of CMV reactivation, so not necessarily CMV disease, but just the reactivation of the virus, on hematological disease, relapse, and non-relapse mortality. In their study, they found that CMV reactivation is associated with an increase in non-relapse mortality following allogeneic stem cell transplant. They also found that it's associated with a decrease in overall survival following stem cell transplant. And so the reason that this might occur is because patients who have a CMV reactivation, even if they don't go on to develop clinically significant CMV disease, might be at risk for opportunistic infections because of the immunosuppressive properties of CMV virus. We also know that the viral medications we use to treat CMV reactivation can come with a variety of toxicities that might be a detriment to patients' overall immune recovery and overall recovery following transplant. Our two primary preventative strategies include prophylactic therapy and preemptive therapy. Prophylactic therapy involves providing an antiviral therapy for a pre-specified duration following transplant. The benefits of this strategy include a reduction in CMV infection and disease, and some cons include adverse drug events related to our antivirals, high cost, use of antivirals in patients who may not ever develop a CMV infection, and an increased risk for viral resistance to those antiviral medications. Preemptive therapy is a somewhat newer approach that's made possible by our newer monitoring techniques, including PCR. And it involves monitoring for asymptomatic CMV replication utilizing a PCR weekly. Patients are provided with antiviral treatment upon detection of CMV viremia. Some benefits to this method include a reduction in mortality, limited toxicity from limited use of antivirals, and an acceleration of immune reconstitution because we're not using some of our myelosuppressive prophylactic therapy agents. Some cons of this include lab costs associated with those weekly PCRs, possibility for loss to follow-up, and a possibility for rapid doubling time of CMV viral loads in some patients. To dig a little bit more into the specific antivirals we might use, ganciclovir and valganciclovir have been our mainstay therapy for treating CMV for quite some time. They have the greatest evidence for prevention and treatment, but we do know that they have toxicities that limit their use following stem cell transplant. Acyclovir and valacyclovir have been studied to some extent for CMV prophylaxis following stem cell transplant, but they're not routinely used due to poor efficacy against CMV. And if they are used, they've been studied at much higher doses, which come with a host of side effects as well. And finally is letermovir, which is our newer agent that's approved specifically for CMV prophylaxis in allogeneic stem cell transplant. So with ganciclovir and valganciclovir, we have valganciclovir, which is converted by hydrolysis to ganciclovir within the body, which is then able to enter our CMV-infected cell. Ganciclovir is phosphorylated within the cell by the UL91 kinase, and is further phosphorylated by cellular kinases, which then allows it to inhibit our CMV DNA polymerase. This prevents DNA replication within the cell. Here I have listed some of our prophylaxis and treatment dosing strategies for ganciclovir and valganciclovir. I want to point out that when a patient does develop a CMV viremia noticed by PCR, we utilize induction dosing for a standard of 2 weeks, at which time if the patient does have undetectable CMV viral loads, we can switch over to maintenance therapy for 2 weeks depending on that patient's specific clinical situation. One of the main side effects we're concerned about with these agents is myelosuppression, because these patients are especially tenuous when you think about their immune recovery following transplant as their new donor cells take hold within their bodies. So that's one of the significant concerns with using these medications that might contribute to that decreased overall survival that we see. Jumping back to our patient case, I want to ask the question of, should we provide CMV prophylaxis to our patient? So this brings us to our first audience response question. What strategy would you recommend for prevention of CMV in our patient? Prophylaxis with valganciclovir because our patient is at high risk for CMV. Prophylaxis with letermovir because our patient is at high risk for CMV. Preemptive therapy with initiation of antiviral therapy only if our patient displays signs or symptoms of CMV. Or preemptive therapy with initiation of antiviral therapy if our patient has a detectable CMV DNA viral load. And so I'll give you some time to answer these questions. You can respond via polleverywhere.com/MayoRx or text MayoRx to 22333. And again, there might be some delay, so I'll give some additional time for answers to come in. All right, so looking at our results, there are actually two potential correct answers. Answer A would be incorrect. We don't typically provide valganciclovir to patients for CMV, and mostly because of those myelosuppressive effects. While that was at one point one of our strategies that we used in some patients, we're now favoring other strategies that have demonstrated better efficacy in terms of decreased mortality. Answer B could be correct. This is something we'll get into throughout the remainder of this presentation. C would be incorrect because we do initiate antiviral therapy for patients who have any level of CMV viral load detected by PCR. We would not wait for those disease manifestations to appear because at that point, the patient is already experiencing significant complications from their disease. And so D then would be correct. We'll initiate antiviral therapy if there's any detectable CMV DNA viral load. So now to get into letermovir, it was approved by the FDA in 2017, and it's specifically indicated for CMV prophylaxis and CMV seropositive allogeneic stem cell transplants. The dosing is provided as 480 milligrams orally or intravenously once daily, and there's no studied or recommended treatment dose at this time. The spectrum of coverage is slightly different from what we see with our other antivirals, so there's no coverage of HSV or VZV, and it's important to add on an additional agent to cover those viral infections should you use letermovir. Its mechanism of action is also different from some of our other antiviral medications. It binds to what we call the viral terminase complex within our CMV-infected cell. And the activity of this complex is to cleave viral DNA into genomic units, which are then packaged into capsids and released. So letermovir binds specifically to the UL56 encoded subunit of this viral terminase complex. Our phase 3 letermovir trial included 565 CMV seropositive allogeneic stem cell transplants. And they randomized patients in a 2-to-1 fashion to receive letermovir or matching placebo. They received letermovir for 14 weeks following transplant, which equates to about 100 days following transplant. And they did stratify according to risk status and study site. The primary endpoint was the proportion of patients with undetectable CMV DNA at randomization who had clinically significant CMV infection through week 24 after transplant, so several weeks after the letermovir treatment or prophylaxis had been stopped. Looking at our baseline characteristics, we see patients had a median age of mid-50s, and we also see that the majority of patients had CMV seropositive donors. Remember that all patients were CMV seropositive recipients. Finally, they did include 30% of patients who had high risk of CMV disease, and they defined this as patients who had a mismatched donor that was related or unrelated, a haploidentical donor, patients who had graft versus host disease requiring steroids, and patients who received cord blood. Looking at our primary endpoint, which was clinically significant CMV at week 24, the authors did note a statistically significant difference favoring letermovir to placebo. And I want to point out that they did impute patients who discontinued the trial and patients who had a missing outcome as if they had the primary endpoint. And they did this based on a conversation with regulatory agencies that wanted to better assess the overall clinical efficacy and drug tolerability for patients. So this was a more conservative approach. But as you can see, the main difference that we're seeing between the two groups is based on that clinically significant CMV difference. And for their definition of clinically significant CMV, it was any patient who had CMV infection. So that's the CMV viremia that contributed to that patient receiving preemptive therapy with one of our other antiviral agents. One of their exploratory endpoints was all-cause mortality. And while there was initially a statistically significant difference between all-cause mortality between the two groups, that did not hold through to week 48. They did note that the difference was more pronounced for patients with high risk for CMV, and there was a post hoc analysis that found that there was a significant difference in mortality for patients who had developed a CMV infection while on treatment. Looking at some of our safety outcomes, we saw slightly increased vomiting and edema with letermovir, as well as increased dyspnea, myalgia, atrial fibrillation, and elevated alanine aminotransferase. None of these differences were statistically significant, and overall, the drug was well tolerated. So what is the clinical takeaway from this trial? We saw that with letermovir, we had reduced clinically significant CMV. This included both CMV infection and CMV disease. In the two groups, we only saw a rate of CMV disease of about 1.5 to 1.8%. So we weren't necessarily preventing more CMV disease, but we were preventing the patients from requiring use of ganciclovir. So we're potentially then lowering some of the adverse effects we can see from CMV reactivation itself, as well as from using those antiviral medications. I want to dig a little bit more into some drug interactions that we have when using letermovir. One of the more significant interactions is with our calcineurin inhibitors. So letermovir is a substrate of our OATP and P-glycoprotein, which are all inhibited by cyclosporin. And in our phase 3 trial, we did utilize a reduced dose of letermovir of 240 milligrams daily in patients receiving concomitant cyclosporins. And this was based off of some pharmacokinetic data that came out in phase 1 and phase 2 studies. We also know that cyclosporin and tacrolimus are metabolized by CYP3A4, and letermovir can inhibit this function. So one of the studies I'll be presenting looks into whether or not we should be preemptively adjusting our cyclosporin or tacrolimus doses. So this study was a single center retrospective study, including 46 patients who were CMV seropositive and received letermovir following allogeneic stem cell transplant. 36 patients received letermovir at 480 milligrams daily with tacrolimus, and 10 of those patients received cyclosporin with a reduced dose of letermovir. And the study's primary endpoint was assessing the percent change in concentration to dose ratio over the 7-day period after initiation of letermovir. So patients tended to have a few dose changes within that 7-day period. And we can see that from baseline to day 4 following initiation of letermovir, the concentration to dose ratio did increase, demonstrating that letermovir was inhibiting some of the metabolism of those agents. Based on this increase in concentration to dose ratios, we don't necessarily need to empirically reduce the dose of our cyclosporine or tacrolimus because we are able to effectively monitor and dose adjust accordingly. But this is something we should be aware of as pharmacists, especially to be able to make those changes as necessary when starting and stopping letermovir. Another potential drug interaction that can be problematic for transplant patients is the interaction with azole antifungals. So this is a pharmacokinetic study conducted in healthy subjects that showed that posaconazole, which is a substrate of PJP, which again can be inhibited by letermovir, did not have a major difference when used with letermovir or without. On the other hand, voriconazole, which is a substrate of CYP2C9 and 2C19, which are induced by letermovir, we did see a decrease in the AUC and the Cmax when we use voriconazole with letermovir compared to voriconazole alone. And based on these studies, I wouldn't necessarily recommend empiric dose changes, but I think it's important to note that those drug interactions do exist, and you could consider obtaining antifungal levels a week after initiation of letermovir, especially if you're using voriconazole. So this is our Mayo Clinic post-transplant standard operating procedure. And as you can see, for our high-risk allogeneic stem cell transplants, which include patients who have undergone a haploidentical cord blood or mismatched transplant, we do recommend providing letermovir when either the donor or the recipient is CMV seropositive. Letermovir is provided from day zero, starting from day 0 to day 28, up through day 100, and we do still monitor weekly PCRs in those patients. For negative donor and recipient patients and low-risk patients, we don't recommend prophylaxing with letermovir, and instead we use the preemptive approach with CMV monitoring. So now jumping back to our case, with our 47-year-old female who's day plus 10 from an allogeneic stem cell transplant, we had a haploidentical donor and the patient received a myeloablative conditioning regimen. The patient was CMV seropositive with a seronegative donor. And now I want to ask again, should we provide CMV prophylaxis? In this case, our answer would likely be yes. And that's because of some of the risk factors that the patient have that put her in that high risk for CMV category. And we know that CMV reactivation on its own can cause some clinically significant harm. So this brings us to our next question. Which patient would benefit the most from letermovir prophylaxis? Answer A is autologous stem cell transplant, CMV seropositive recipient. Answer B is a patient receiving an allogeneic cord blood stem cell transplant from a CMV seronegative donor and recipient. Answer C is an allogeneic stem cell transplant recipient with a mismatched unrelated donor who is CMV seropositive with a seronegative donor. And answer D is an allogeneic stem cell transplant recipient with a matched related donor who is CMV seronegative with a seropositive donor. I'll give you some time to read those over and submit your answers. All right, so we'll go through each of these. So answer A would be incorrect. We don't use letermovir for prophylaxis in patients who've received an autologous stem cell transplant, so it would not be a useful therapy in this case. For answer B, it's incorrect, and this is because we have both donor and recipient CMV seronegative status, so the patient wouldn't be at as high of a risk for developing CMV reactivation. Answer C would be correct. So this is an allogeneic stem cell transplant with a mismatched unrelated donor, and that mismatch is really the key that differentiates us from the following answer. So although we do have a CMV seropositive recipient, we do have the CMV seropositive recipient, which kind of puts us into that high-risk category, and then that mismatch contributes additional risk for CMV reactivation. And for answer D, it would be incorrect because we have a matched related donor. And so although we have that CMV seropositive donor status, we wouldn't necessarily be at as high of a risk for developing CMV reactivation. So now that we've kind of gone through our first two objectives, we're going to move on to identify investigational uses of letermovir. And there are many future potential applications for letermovir. We're really just kind of in the beginning stages of using it for viral infections. And so I'm going to go through a few different uses. First, we'll be talking about resistant or refractory CMV, and then secondary prophylaxis of CMV infection and disease, and finally, prevention and treatment of CMV in solid organ transplant and other at-risk populations. So for resistant or refractory CMV, we have to kind of first think about what causes resistance to our more commonly utilized antiviral agents. So as I had mentioned before, ganciclovir is phosphorylated initially by UL91 kinase. So one potential mechanism of resistance is through a mutation within that kinase that prevents the phosphorylation of ganciclovir. And this typically occurs more early than our other mutations. So another mutation that can occur is a mutation in UL54, which alters the structure of our DNA polymerase and prevents binding of ganciclovir. And this mutation also confers risk to some of our other antiviral agents, such as foscarnet and cidofovir. Our rates of resistant CMV in stem cell transplant recipients ranges anywhere from 1.7 to 14.5%. And refractory CMV ranges from 29 to 39%. And these are typically associated with poor outcomes. So as you can see, this can be a significant problem for patients who do develop CMV infection. Some risk factors for resistance include prolonged antiviral treatment, poor host immune response to CMV, and reduced drug delivery. And while there isn't much data yet on letermovir for use in these populations, there was this case study which had four patients who'd received a lung transplant, one patient who had received an allostem cell transplant, and they used letermovir for patients who had resistant or refractory CMV. In the latter three patients, the medications that are bolded were used in combination with letermovir for an approach that would target multiple mechanisms within the CMV-infected cell. The majority of patients did have a favorable response when adding on letermovir, although we can see this did take some time. So patient one, it took 6 weeks to achieve a CMV viral load less than 200. In patient number two, we did unfortunately see an increase in the viral load. In patients three and four, we did see that, again, it took some time to achieve that that less than 200 CMV viral load. And we did see a reduction in the viremia in our fifth patient as well. So again, this is just an early study demonstrating that there may be some benefit, particularly with combined use for letermovir for resistant or refractory CMV. And this in part stems from its different mechanism of action. There is an ongoing single group phase two study, including 32 patients, which will evaluate letermovir for refractory or resistant CMV in patients with concurrent organ dysfunction, which may prevent them or preclude them from receiving ganciclovir, valganciclovir, or some of our other agents, such as foscarnet and cidofovir, which can be more nephrotoxic. One of the concerns with letermovir is that in vitro studies have suggested that selection for resistance is relatively low. They have a low genetic barrier to resistance. In our phase three study that I presented earlier, there was only one patient that was found to have resistance, and this was mediated by a mutation in that UL56 portion of the viral terminase complex that letermovir binds to. And this is something we might see play out as we have further studies evaluating use of letermovir. So jumping back to our patient case, our 47-year-old female is now day 56 following transplant, and we've elected to use a letermovir prophylaxis strategy. The patient is admitted to the hospital with abdominal pain and fever. She has a CMV DNA viral load of 9,430, and they suspect CMV colitis based on her symptoms and viremia. They attempt to treat with ganciclovir, but experience a failure of treatment and have identified mutations in UL54 and UL97. Which of the following is true regarding the use of letermovir in this patient for resistant CMV? Answer A, letermovir has demonstrated efficacy against resistant CMV in recent randomized clinical trials. Answer B, use of letermovir prophylaxis may predispose this patient to develop letermovir-resistant CMV. Answer C, letermovir should not be combined with other antiviral agents for resistant CMV. And answer D, letermovir would not be effective in this patient because of the UL54 mutation. All right, so we'll go through each of these answers now. So for answer A, letermovir has demonstrated efficacy against resistant CMV in recent randomized clinical trials. Unfortunately, at this point, we don't have randomized clinical trials, and it might not be something that would be easy to accomplish in the future either. We don't have those trials available to help guide our use at this time. Use of letermovir prophylaxis may predispose this patient to development of letermovir resistance. This is a potential concern with letermovir, so this would be the correct answer. So that could be one reason that we might want to avoid using letermovir prophylaxis if we want to save this agent to be used in a resistant or refractory case of CMV. But that's a risk-benefit conversation that would be patient-specific, and at this point, as we don't really have data to support use for resistance, I think we're better off using it upfront for prophylaxis in general. Answer C, letermovir should not be combined with other antiviral agents for resistant CMV. That's not true. As we've seen in the case series I presented, it can be beneficial to combine it with those other agents because of the difference in their mechanism. And D, letermovir would not be effective in this patient because of the UL54 mutation. So unlike our other antiviral medications, letermovir doesn't bind to the DNA polymerase and therefore wouldn't be affected or shouldn't be affected by the UL54 mutation. Now to move on to secondary prophylaxis of CMV infection and disease. So this is the use of letermovir following a primary infection with CMV following transplant to potentially prevent recurrent CMV. There was a study that included 80 CMV seropositive adult patients who had at least one episode of CMV infection or disease following stem cell transplant. These patients received letermovir for secondary prophylaxis of CMV. And the authors found that four patients, or 5.5%, did develop breakthrough CMV infection. Three of the patients of those four had documented CMV UL56 mutation. So this study demonstrated that letermovir could potentially play a role to bridge patients from treatment for that initial infection through to a CMV-specific immune reconstitution, which again could take months to years depending on the patient. But we did see a higher rate of resistance in general for patients within this study than we'd seen in the initial phase 3 study. And that might be a result of those patients having a CMV infection develop and then being at higher risk for recurrent CMV. There's also a single group phase 2 study that's currently recruiting, which will detect letermovir for prevention of recurrent CMV infection following transplant. And then finally, we'll look at prevention and treatment of CMV in solid organ transplant and other at-risk populations. So there was a small case series that included 8 heart or lung transplant patients, and they utilized letermovir for prophylaxis of CMV. And they did this because those patients were not able to receive traditional antiviral therapy. 3 of the patients in their cohort did develop CMV infection, and there were no major side effects reported. So they conclude that while letermovir was well tolerated, there was a higher rate of development of CMV infection. And this is a small study, but it kind of draws into question whether or not we'll be able to utilize letermovir in other populations. Fortunately, we do have a randomized phase 3 trial that's currently recruiting 600 patients to assess letermovir in comparison with valganciclovir to prevent CMV post-kidney transplant. We also have a study that's looking at CMV prophylaxis in patients who are treated with alemtuzumab, which can be T-cell depleting. So that wraps up our future potential applications. And in summary, a preemptive strategy is typically favored in stem cell transplant recipients. And this is because we're able to avoid the myelosuppressive effects of our antiviral medications that were previously commonly used. Letermovir may be used for CMV prophylaxis in allogeneic stem cell recipients. But we do here at Mayo reserve the risk for the use for high-risk patients. And finally, future uses of letermovir may include resistant or refractory CMV, secondary prophylaxis for recurrent CMV, and prophylaxis or treatment in solid organ transplant or other at-risk groups.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.